Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering kayaks, canoes, and outdoor equipment for anyone wanting to experience the natural beauty of Wisconsin water. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or rutabagashop.com.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Remember records?
So I had just bought a house. I just moved in there. I was just walking around the neighborhood right as we'd kind of finished construction. I set up the turntable, and all of a sudden there was this new record store that had recently opened and I'd never seen it. And of course it was a 4-minute walk from my front door.
Writer David Sachs.
This place, June Records, it was almost like an Apple store in the way they designed it. All white, very clean, very precise in the way they'd organize the racks. It had that fresh record store smell. They didn't have a window display. They had a turntable in the window and a little speaker outside that was playing what was going on.
I'd like to leave you saying, reach out and turn.
And it was this Aretha Franklin album, which was Aretha live at the Fillmore West, I think 1971 or 72. Music had almost vanished from my life. And suddenly here it was, spinning this disc of melted plastic with sound waves pressed into it, and Aretha Franklin's voice coming out of it. What kind of a heartless human being would I be to continue walking down the block and not pop into the store and buy that Aretha record and start adding to a record collection that I really hadn't built up in a couple of years?
So a lot of us are having this kind of experience, falling in love with something like a vinyl record, or maybe a camera with film, or a beautiful notebook that you can write in with pens, not pixels. But what is behind this analog renaissance? Well, Steve Paulson asked David Sachs, author of The Revenge of Analog.
The best analogy I have for it is the world of food, right? We're able to process bread to get flour in a way that it would have this incredibly long shelf life, and we didn't have to worry about spoilage and hunger, you know, going back to pre-World War II. And all of a sudden, you know, by the 70s, a lot of people were saying, all right, I'm tired of this Wonder Bread. I'm tired of this. What else is there? Let's go back to making sourdough the way it was. Whereas now, you can't swing a mocha chai latte without hitting an artisanal toast somewhere. And it's very much a move backward, right? It's very much looking at the way things were done, not out of a sense of nostalgia, but actually looking at the qualitative experience and saying, yes, okay, now that I know I can eat what I want in the most efficient and expensive way, when I choose to eat something, when I have some extra money, when I have extra time to cook things, where am I going to go? I'm going to look at what's going to give me the richest experience.
It's interesting that you used the word nostalgia, because that is one explanation for why there is this return to all this sort of handmade stuff or, you know, physical stuff. Or it's the hipsters. The hipsters are the ones who go and, you know, are buying all the vinyl records.
Or my favorite, the nostalgic hipsters. Now at Urban Outfitters, which is funny. I was emailing with someone from Urban Outfitters and, you know, they acknowledge that nostalgia is a lot of their bread and butter. First of all, I don't think there's anything wrong with nostalgia, right?
Is there anything wrong with nostalgic hipsters?
They cannot exist without it. That is their nature. It is like riding a bike with more than one gear.
But what's interesting is that you do both. I mean, it's not as if you've rejected your digital life here, but you sort of have these two simultaneous worlds, the analog world and the digital world.
And I think that's the part of the argument that those who say it's just nostalgia don't really understand. Nostalgia would involve people sort of going Ted Kaczynski and moving to a cabin in Montana and only using a typewriter. The reality is most of the people embracing analog goods and ideas today are doing it in concert and in parallel with the digital tools that they're using either in work or for their personal lives. So when you go into a coffee shop or a lecture hall at the University of Wisconsin, someone is sitting there at their desk working on a project for whatever business they're in. They're going to have a laptop open. They're going to have a smartphone next to it. And next to that, they're going to have a paper notebook, a Moleskine notebook or a Field Notes notebook or some other random collection of paper with a pen. It's not as though these things are competing with each other. These technologies are complementary. And it's the use of all of them simultaneously and in concert that's what allows those people to work at their best. So certain ideas are going to go down on paper and then be transferred and refined on the laptop screen. Each serves its own purpose, and that purpose is very individual to the user, to each of us. I think it's that mixture that allows us to move with the digital technology in a way that actually doesn't feel as though things are escaping or moving too fast from us. It grounds us in something that's familiar, in behaviors and patterns that are in many ways functional and are not inferior to the digital technology. For a lot of people, even people who work at very high-tech companies, it actually allows them to work better with the digital technology.
Right. Now, one of the more surprising trends that you write about is the return of the bricks and mortar bookstore. And it turns out even Amazon, the big chain that basically killed Borders, has opened physical bookstores in cities like Seattle, Chicago, Portland, Oregon. How do you explain the return of the bookstore?
There's a couple of different factors here. There's the economic factor of sort of the Great Recession. And the reality was that Amazon may have played a role in the contraction of independent bookstores when there was, you know, 4,000 or more, let's say in the 1980s, up to it's about 1,800, 1,900 today, independent bookstores. You know, most of that was due to Borders and Barnes & Noble. And what were Borders and Barnes & Noble and other sort of big chains able to do that those bookstores weren't? They were able to offer the lowest price and the biggest selection, the most books at the lowest prices, which the mom and pop had a lot of trouble competing with. Well, Amazon came along and said, we can offer every book forever, and we're willing to take a loss on all of them because our real business is raising our stock price and selling data services or drones to someone. And that really hit Borders, who went bankrupt, and Barnes & Noble, who has continually struggled to sort of maintain their place and has contracted somewhat. But it changed the narrative for the independents. The independents could say, we're not going to offer you the most. We're going to actually offer you a curated selection, a very personal selection to this community.
And we're going to offer you an experience. You come into the bookstores, it's not just to buy a book. There's more going on there.
It's community, right? It is a place where ideas live and thrive, and you can have conversations with people and see authors there. When you think about the great bookstores around the country, Books and Books in Miami and Powell's in Portland, Oregon, and City Lights in San Francisco, and on and on and on. These places are hubs of a community. They're places where you can go and take your kids for a couple hours and just sit them in the kids section and let them read stories and flip through books. There are places where you can walk in and say you're starting a book club and ask for recommendations and have a conversation. Have someone open you up to new ideas. That is a premium. That is something that people increasingly value. They know, everybody who shops at these stores, they know you can buy those same books cheaper at other places. But it sells really well in those types of stores because those who value books, they realize that it's a small luxury in their life. It is something that's worth paying for. And they also have seen what happens to their communities when those stores leave, right? When a bookstore isn't in a community, it doesn't get replaced by something of an equal cultural cachet of an equal place. It gets replaced by a pharmacy or, God forbid, a vape store. Where you could go in and have an intellectual conversation about what it tastes like to smoke grape.
You have other examples of this revenge of the analog. And one of them is you talk about the summer camp you went to as a kid, Camp Walden, which I guess has banned a lot of digital devices, right?
Yeah, there's this interesting choice that summer camps now have to make because digital technology is ubiquitous in the lives of their campers. And so they've decided, is this something we want? Do we want all the kids to have cell phones and Instagram every day on the canoe docks? Or do we want this to be sort of a screen-free space? And so Walden made this choice. It would be a screen-free space. And they enforce it. So they said, if we catch anyone with a phone, any device that has a connection, we're going to take it away and send it back to your parents. And, you know, you'll be punished. You won't get extra snack on nacho night. But what was interesting is that every summer, there's still a dozen or more kids that bring up phones. They get caught by doing stupid things like liking the post of their photo on the camp's Facebook page. They're still kids. And it was interesting. I went back to Walden a couple summers ago. I spent the night there in the same old bunk that I slept in as a 9-year-old. And I remember talking to some of these kids whose phones had been taken from them and asking them why they did it. And it was, in many cases, their parents wanting to stay in touch with them, but also this fear of missing out. And once they had had the phones removed from them, they said it was the best thing ever. It was like this weight had been lifted. The anxiety was gone, and they could just be kids. They could have those connections that the other 10 months of the year when they're constantly on Snapchat or Instagram, even when they're with their friends, they don't have. And so they had a deeper relationship. They built deeper relationships.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that I'm guessing that these kids are young enough that they've probably grown up with all of these digital devices. I mean, they've never known life without them.
There's a great story I have from last summer, which is when my friend's daughter, Abby, turned 9, and she was at our house on her birthday. And she got a Fujifilm Instax camera, which is Fujifilm's very popular instant film camera. That was the gift that she had begged her parents for. That's what she wanted, okay? This is a girl who has only known photography as something that happens on an iPhone or an iPad her entire life. Why did she want a film camera? Not nostalgia. She'd never heard of film before. She had no connection to Polaroids in the past. It was not something she knew about other than what was on the cover of a Taylor Swift album. To her, it was its own thing. It was a magical thing that could spit out a photo that she could give to her friend, she could write on, she could tack to her wall. She saw the benefit of that in a way that even her parents and my generation is still ambivalent about. You know, oh, well, that's an old thing. That's nostalgia. You're just being a nostalgic hipster. A 9-year-old is not a nostalgic hipster. They see the value of analog goods, of time away from the screen, if it's given to them, if they're given the opportunity for it. And these kids at the summer camp saw the same thing, right? The kids at Walden, 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 13-year-olds, they said, of course, we love our phones, we're always on it, but we value this time. We look forward to these 2 months because it's that time away from it, when we have to do other things, when we have to sit by a campfire and play with whoopee cushions and do these things that kids naturally love, they get a joy from, but they're almost prevented from doing it by the constant presence of digital technology.
The record stuck, the record stuck, the record stuck, the record stuck.
David Sacks is the author of The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. He talked with Steve Paulson.